Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Birmingham, Michigan, and earned a degree from Wayne State University in mortuary science. He and his four brothers then joined their dad's funeral firm in the 70s. He is the author of five collections of poems and The Undertaking, Life Studies from the Dismal Trade, which PBS turned into an Emmy Award-winning documentary. His latest book is entitled The Good Funeral. His name, Thomas Lynch, and we're honored to have him as our guest. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything is Possible, and we're talking to Thomas Lynch, world-famous poet mortician. Tom, welcome. A real honor to have you.
Thanks, Jack. I'm glad for your interest. That thing about world-famous poets, I always say they're internationally unknown poets.
Speaking of which, when you were a kid, talk about your childhood and your mom and your dad.
Well, it takes on that sort of idyllic glaze to it. Now, I grew up in a large family. There were nine of us. My father had returned from the South Pacific, having survived island warfare with the U.S. Marines, and he had been in love with a girl he met in the fifth grade, and they got married, and they began to make babies, as they do, and I was the second of those, and I had a brother on either side of me. Soon we had sisters, and I always think of it this time of year as, you know, the trees go bald and, you know, we've got bags of Halloween candy. And I just think it was fairly idyllic. We knew that we were loved and abundantly. We had good family relationships. We were part of a tribe that had religious connections to the local church. And I always felt sort of out of place, because when I was going to the university in the 60s, everybody always had some trouble from their childhood they wanted to report, and I couldn't think of any, you know? I mean, it was blessed.
The word on the street is that you were Mom's favorite. At least that's what your brothers say. True?
Well, I think my mother's great gift was that she could make every one of her children and every one of her friends and every one of her large extended family feel like they were all favorites. That was a real gift that Rosemary O'Hara had, and it never left her. She could light the room with her smile, and she could, her disapproval was something you did not, her scrutiny was important. So you wanted to keep on her good side.
Thomas Lynch, where did you get your love for writing?
I think my grandmother's. I think it was more a love for language that, our Sunday afternoons, my widowed grandmothers would always end up at our house, and my father would set them arguing about religion or sex or politics after he'd given them a few drinks. And he'd say to me, you know, just keep your ears peeled. You'll learn more from those women than you'll ever learn at school. And it turns out that it was true, because they would argue over anything. They were opposites in most things, politically and otherwise. So I think their contentions were, for me, a kind of education, and their rich appreciation for language and the sounds of their own voices and each other's voices were replicated. You know, later on, we'd grow up. I remember we would always have big family discussions at the dinner table. And we never regarded disagreement as threatening. It was always a sign that we took one another seriously. So
In 1970,
that made a difference.
In 1970, you went to England to find your family and read Yeats and Joyce. By your own admission, Tom, it changed your life. How and why?
It was actually to the west of Ireland, Jack, and it was, I had gotten a high number in the Nixon draft lotto, and so I knew I wasn't going to be going to Vietnam, which men of my generation had as a kind of pall overhead anything that they planned to do, either academically or otherwise. I was at university. I wasn't much of a student, so I thought, I'll go to Ireland and find my family roots, you know. And I did. I found, my grandfather's first cousins, Tommy and Nora Lynch, a bachelor and spinster, brother and sister, living a pretty primeval life on the west coast of County Clare. And I stayed for 3 or 4 months and learned things that I couldn't have learned otherwise. And I just kept going back.
When and why did you start to write poetry?
Well, I love the sound of rhymes. I can remember, I think, when I was a child, the prayer we said at bedtime was a rhymed poem. Angel of God, my guardian dear, to whom God's love commits me here. And, my Methodist friend next door had a similar prayer. Now I lay me down to sleep and pray the Lord my soul to keep. And this, the rhyme and meter of those of that raised speech created such an acoustic pleasure in my ear, I thought, well, I'll keep reading that. So poetry was a natural extension of that attraction.
Tom, when you're writing a poem, how do you know when it's finished?
It sort of runs out of its own energy. There's a much the same as when it's getting going. It gets going on the steam of maybe one line or one word or one image or one sound. And then I use forms a lot. So I know I just did a book called The Sin Eater, and the first of the Sin Eater poems I wrote years ago had 24 lines in it. So then I kept doing them, but they all had 24 lines. And then I finished a book of them after I had 24 of them. So I thought 24 by 24, there's a certain orderliness to that, and made a book out of them.
We're talking to Thomas Lynch, and he and his four brothers joined their dad's funeral firm in the 70s. When we come back, we'll talk to him about that. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Krasula, and we're with Thomas Lynch. Tom, what's the single biggest thing your dad taught you and your brothers about the funeral home business?
He would always say, Jack, our job is to serve the living by caring for the dead. And I think that formula, that there is this connection between the living and the dead, and our care for one served the interests of the other, was for me very illuminating. The other thing he'd say is, if you take care of the service, the sales will take care of themselves. I've just really admired about him the fact that he separated the stuff from the substance of funeral service.
It seems to me that a funeral director needs great compassion. Talk to us about compassion.
From my standpoint, I find that all of us easily identify with the joys and sorrows we find in others. I think I don't think there's anything particularly compassionate about funeral directors, but if they do not identify, if they do not empathize with the human plight of heartbreak and sorrow and grief and bereavement, then they probably should look for work elsewhere. I do know, though, that not only do you have to identify with the heartache, you also have to see the strength of faith, the power of human attachment, how we uphold one another through the most difficult times. To be witness to that is a real gift, I must say, after doing this for 40 or 50 years.
In 1997, you wrote The Undertaking, Life Studies from the Dismal Trade. What's the basic message of that book?
I think I was trying to complete something I had told my father. He had died. My mother died in 89. My father died in 92. And they were both too young as far as I was concerned. We loved them very, very much. But they left us this huge legacy of family and our work together. And my father had always asked me when I was going to write a book about funeral service. And so I set to work soon after his death, writing essays. And they sort of connected all together and eventually led to this book called The Undertaking. And it started with the notion that an undertaking is a pledge, a promise to do something and to get it done. And I had promised my father to do something relevant to what we did as a family in our work. And so I felt like doing that book completed that undertaking.
Well, talk to us about the documentary that PBS made, the Emmy Award-winning, upon the book, The Undertaking.
Well, Frontline is the great documentary filmmaking company in the world. It was the executive producer is David Fanning. And David called me, and it was maybe 10 years before, maybe it was in 1997 or thereabouts, or 1994, he had read an essay of mine in Harper's Magazine, and he wanted to come out to Milford just to shadow us, to see what it was we do. And he brought with him a young filmmaker by the name of Karen O'Connor, and they wanted to make a film eventually. And I said, well, I wasn't ready for that yet. But over the course of another 10 or 12 years, they kept in touch and kept asking if there was any possibility. And finally, in 1996, I think it was, after I had a film made by an Irish company about what we do, I thought, well, it's like having a second root canal. You may as well have it taken care of now. So I invited them out, and they made that film. And we're proud of that film because it... the families that let their stories be open to the general public were very courageous, and I think it is a great teaching tool.
Thomas Lynch is a writer and a poet.
They die around the clock here without apparent preference for a day or the week. There is no clear favorite in the way of seasons.
He's also the funeral director in a small town in central Michigan.
This is Anthony, our son, who is 24 months old. And he is not a baby who communicates in any sort of normal, expected way.
You still get the question, well, why isn't he eating? And my answer is because he's dying. Because he's dying.
I can't prepare for that completely, you know. But it gives us steps, traditions, or something that we follow that maybe will help us survive and finding a way to honor him.
She was diagnosed with lung cancer, and within a couple of weeks, she checked herself into hospice.
Cremation is what you've chosen. Cremation, Aunt Mary, would you like to be cremated?
Yes.
Death seems to be a kind of punctuation. Life seems richer because we're mortal, because it won't last forever. And I've noticed that not only in my own experience, but in the experience of, you know, the families that we've served over the years, that while death is a terrible heartache and a great sadness, it does sort of accentuate the life in the same way that, you know, the exclamation point or the question mark or the period ends a good sentence.
Your latest book, co-authored with Thomas Long, is an oxymoron, The Good Funeral. Tom, why that title?
It was taken actually from something my father used to say when he would come home from work. He'd loosen his gray tie and kick off his wingtip shoes, and if it was in the middle of summer, he'd take off his starched white shirt and sit down at the table and say, we had a couple good funerals today. And I always wonder how you could put good with funeral, because they seemed like opposite ends of the register. But having done this now for many, many years, I do know that funerals can be very, very good. And if they miss the mark, they can be very bad. And having the opportunity to work with the theologian Thomas Long, who had authored a book called Accompany Them with Singing, The Christian Funeral, I thought, from his perspective as a pastor and preacher and theologian, and my perspective as a funeral director and undertaker and poet, we might be able to come up with something that would really help young clergy and young funeral directors and the wider general audience of readers. And I think we've done that. The Good Funeral is a book I'm very proud of.
I quote you again, funerals are the way we close the gap between the death that happens and the death that matters. Please.
Well, Jack, you know, the newspapers, the news accounts are full of deaths that happen that seem not to matter. They're too many. There are too remote. And yet, when a death occurs in our families, then I say the death matters. And that's why a funeral is the way we sort of close the space between, you know, all of the deaths that happen and the death that happens to us, which is the death of a parent or a sibling or a spouse or, God help us, a child. Those deaths matter immediately, and they are emergency situations. And that's why, one of the reasons why, you know, we answer the phone in the middle of the night and in the middle of dinner, in the middle of holidays, because when such deaths happen, people call us.
One more quote. What a funeral does is get the dead where they need to go and the living where they need to be.
Yeah, I think it is by doing what we're supposed to do with the dead. I've often said, Jack, that ours is a species that deals with the idea of death by dealing with the dead, the thing itself. And so I think it is that by getting the dead to the grave or the tomb or the fire in a way that gives us pause to look into the whatever the oblivion we're consigning them to and ask, I think, signature questions. You know, like, is that all there is? Are we all alone? Can this happen to me? What comes next? These are questions that make our species different from all other species. And I really do think that we are obliged to get our dead where they need to go. And by doing so, we get where we need to be.
If you want to learn more, www.thomaslynch.com. And as we go to a break, Tom, could you recite one of your poems?
Yeah. This is a poem called After You're Going, and it's, find it in this book. I happen to have it. After You're Going. There was this hollow after you're going, as if the air you'd lately occupied, having waited for you these long years, sighed at your leaving, as if the light were lonely, and the day bereft, and the evening lost without your habitation, and the room, once you vacated it, returned to stone and fire and a chair and the old ghosts.
After You're Going, Thomas Lynch. And I'm Jack Crisula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Crisula, and we're with Thomas Lynch, world-famous poet, mortician. Tom, what's the importance and what's problematic about the disappearance of bodies from funerals?
That's a really good question, Jack, and you've probably noticed, as I have, particularly over the past 30 or 40 years, more and more we get invited to these commemorative events that are notable for the fact that, do you know, the finger food is good and the talk is uplifting and the music is life-affirming and someone is on hand, usually a member of the Reverend clergy, to proclaim closure just before the Merlot runs out. And everyone is welcome but the one who has died. And that person, that body, has sort of gone missing, disposed of usually without witness or rubric by someone like me. And one of the reasons that Tom Long and I wanted to write The Good Funeral was to see if we couldn't redeem some of the essential characteristics of a good funeral, one of which was sort of the care of the corpse and the obligations to get the corpse where they needed to go, because we thought in doing so it's how the living sort of acted out the larger story of our mortality and, you know, the journey that we have often seen the dead making from one place to the other. So I don't know. I think the bodiless obsequy, the funeral without the body present, is sort of the commemorative equivalent of going to a wedding without the bride and groom there, or maybe going to a baptism without the baby on hand. And I think it sort of lacks an essential manifest. And so I would like to see a return to those types of funerals where the corpse is not incidental to what's going on. It is the reason we're doing the things we're doing.
Another quote, where you've stated that the main theme of your writing is based on the notion that sex and death and love and grief and vitality and mortality are the essential bookends, and everything in between is open game. But you have to have this punctuation at the beginning and at the end. Why?
Well, I should confess that I stole that notion from a letter that was written between the poet Ezra Pound and the poet William Butler Yeats, in which Yeats was quoting a conversation he had with one of his paramours, Olivia Shakespeare, in which he told her, "The only thing a studious mind should be interested in is sex and death." And I thought, I was 20 at the time, and I thought, how very nice for me, because I really like sex, and the dead seemed to be everywhere because I was working at my father's funeral home. So, but over time, it's turned out to be true that if we understand the things that get us into this world and the things that get us out of this world, it surely does illuminate much of what goes on in our life and times through this world. So I've stuck with that notion, and my writing seems to go in that direction as well.
Tom, no wonder your mom could never get mad at you with your ability to put these words together. What have the thousands of funerals you've helped with taught you, Thomas Lynch?
I guess it's taught me that humans are really good to one another. When I see the parents of an infant that has died, or a teenager that's been killed tragically in an accident or some misadventure, when I see them walking upright and taking care of one another, and when I see their friends coming to support them and hold them and care for them, it makes me believe in a loving God, which is something that, you know, I'm named for a famous doubter, Jack, so I question everything. But when I see the kindnesses people tender to one another in the most difficult times, it makes me believe that someone's in charge here and is sort of taking care of the exits and the entrances and protecting the borders and watching over us.
Speaking of good people, you've been blessed to observe and see stories of hundreds of the greatest generation passing. They're vanishing before our very eyes. Talk to us about that greatest generation.
Well, I'm a baby boomer. I was born in 1948, so I got to watch my parents sort of grow up. My mother died when she was 65, and I turned 65 this year, and I just think, how did she manage to accomplish all that she did in what seems to me now a blink of an eye? And how did my father come home from horrible, horrible combat in the South Pacific? Terrible things that happened that are part of history, but nothing he ever talked about. And not become a bitter, broken man. He started a business, started a family, and worked his way through, and was vastly in love with the woman of his dreams, and died a happy man, thanks be to God. So I just think that's greatness. If you can go through life and have the people you love know that you love them, and the people that love you know that you know it. I think that's sort of the intimate contract among humans, and they both enjoyed that.
At most funerals, Tom, you observe three generations of families, and you see families at their most vulnerable. Talk to us about families.
The dynamics are very, very interesting, and I've always counted it a gift that we're sort of let right into the family dynamics, so we know who the nosy aunt is and the selfish brother, or every family has an interesting cast of characters, and but in general, I have found that there is strength in numbers, and the more people who have to bear the burden of a death in the family, the lighter that burden becomes for each individual. But grief is work. I mean, and I think the shoulder work and the shovel work, and these are large muscle jobs, tasks to be done, and that's and the heart is the largest muscle, they say. Well, it's there's heavy lifting when a death occurs, and I've seen that families help each other doing it.
We're talking to Thomas Lynch. If you want to learn more, www.thomaslynch.com. Tom, there's only one God. And you've seen hundreds of religions in your role. What have you learned about God from all of these experiences?
Well, what I've surmised is something my Methodist grandmother used to tell me after she would describe to us her conversion experience. She converted to what she would ever after call the one true faith, Tom, and she would append a question mark in that little lilt at the end of her statement. But, her belief was that we were all God's children, whomever God is. And I have to say, I'm all my religious upbringing and my religious practice and my reading on this subject, it hasn't told me as much about God as it's told me more about, my brothers and sisters and my fellow humans. And I do believe that we are all God's children, and whoever God is. So I often say, thanks be to God, whoever she is, because sometimes it seems like God is a mother instead of a father. Other times he seems very fatherly, but how am I to know these things? I think the only tenet of faith I have is if whoever God is, it isn't me, and it seems to work out.
Another poem in your recent book entitled Walking Papers is entitled Alchemy. Can you share us Alchemy?
Yeah, it was actually written, Jack, for my uncle and aunt, Marilyn, my godmother, and may her memory be eternal, on their anniversary. After everything, it's like the tune we kept humming over and over, mostly for how it makes us remember somewhere back in our shimmering youths, before the household and the furniture, before the children and the mortgage and the pets, back when it was only the two of us, only each other to abide, obey, suffer and satisfy, endure, survive, only one another to have and hold, and that hush that would sometimes settle between us and the light, how it turned silver in the dark till everything we touched turned into gold. In time, we came to know that tune by heart.
Alchemy by Thomas Lynch. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible. I'm with Thomas Lynch. His latest book, newest book, is entitled The Good Funeral, which he co-authored with Thomas Long. Tom, I've been blessed to be at the bedside when my mom and my dad passed to the Ultimate Championship. And through that, I've come to realize that I think it's more a blessing for the loved ones to be around the one passing than it even is for the one passing. Why is that?
Well, I was there when my mother died, and I envy you the fact that you were there when your father died, because my dad died in Florida, so I wasn't there. But I think we know a holy space when we occupy one, don't we? And when someone is dying, and when someone dies, I think it's the deepest end of the pool we humans play in. It's interesting to me, Jack, that the word grave has the same root word as the word gravid, which means to be pregnant. So anybody who spends a lot of time around dying people and pregnant women know that they're playing in the deep end of the pool. It's full of gravitas. It's very serious and very holy.
Speaking of death, a couple of months ago on August 20th, we lost an icon, Detroit's own Charles Dickens, Elmore Leonard. Why did we love to read him so much?
I think he got the words right. Do you know? He observed his own rules, one of which was take out the part that people won't read. He was a hard-working, day-in, day-out storyteller, and we heard in his dialogues our own voices. So, yeah, he was very, very, very special indeed. A month after Dutch Leonard died, Seamus Heaney died in Ireland, and I happened to be flying to Ireland. I had a ticket in hand on the morning that he died, so I was there for his funeral, which was, like Elmore Leonard's, magnificent in the way that it captured the man. So I saw it a blessing to be at Elmore's funeral and to be at Seamus's funeral.
Elmore had 10 points on writing, and the 10th was, the most important rule is one that sums up the other 9. If it sounds like writing, I rewrite it.
Yeah. Yeah, there was no... he was into fundamental wordplay, not fashionable wordplay. So, yeah, if it sounded too made or constructed, it would give away his meaning. So he always made it sound just like everyday speech.
This is a quote from the Weekly Raider. In a world of hyphenated descriptors, Thomas Lynch has to have one of the oddest, mortician-poet. Tom, what do morticians and poets have in common?
Well, I think that's a good quote. I've often wrestled with that. I mean, in some ways, they're both trying to come up with ways to express unspeakable things, great love, great hope, great hurt, great heartache. I think we're at the same thing. As my wife often says, you know, an undertaker who's a poet is a little bit like a proctologist with a sideline and root canal. Neither of them are too attractive. So if they love you, they love you for yourself, which is good news.
You keep mentioning Ireland. Talk to us about Ireland.
Well, in so many ways, Jack, for me, I found Ireland to be a country that was 50 or 75 years before my time in suburban southeastern lower Michigan. So to find people who still lived in an agricultural, rural setting without all of the trappings of modernity. You know, when I first got to Ireland, there was no phone, no television, no toilet. You know, the roof was thatched, the floor was stone. The toilet was 40 acres out the back. And it just taught me about some of the essentials, including the essential obligations between and among neighbors and friends and family. And I've always counted it a great education, and I still go back for precisely those reasons, because I always learn something about my tribe and my species when I'm there.
If a listener is saying, wow, this man sees things that none of us see. His eyes see so much more. I wish I could live my life that way. How do you see more than we see?
I'm not sure I do. My grandmother always said, enunciate, articulate, and eat more fruit. I think I'd follow that guidance, you know.
Speaking of guidance, as our time winds down tonight, what advice would you give to our young listeners?
Well, I think one of the things that has enriched my life beyond my ability to say thanks for it was a teacher, Michael Heffernan, who told me if I wanted to write, that I should read. His maxim was read and invent. And I would say to young people who are going through school and who may want, you know, who have plans for their future, that the more they read, the better it will be for them. And there's no special list of books, but I do think that writers are readers who go karaoke. They hear in the voices of others something that sounds like themselves, and they begin to imitate that, and then they begin to sound like themselves talking to themselves, and pretty soon they are themselves writing with words this great gift of language that whomever's in charge here gives each of us to use to our own purposes.
Thomas Lynch, thanks for all you've read. The world's better for it, and please keep up the great work.
Thanks, Jack. Thanks for your interest. God bless.
Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spahn.
Believe in yourself.